Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes! Caught Offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
I'm moist, Andrew. It's not a good word to use, but I am moist.
It rains every day here now. Didn't you know this?
Yeah, and it's hard not to get sodden.
Sodden and downtrodden.
A little bit, yeah, but I'm looking forward to this podcast. A lot to talk about.
Yeah,
the football is officially going on forever. It will never stop. And here in North America, we have a lot to talk about. We've so much to talk about.
It will actually never stop to a point where that will kind of invade my red card for today.
I see where you're going with this.
Yeah.
Are you going in a Teutonic German direction with this?
You're talking about the individual?
Yes.
The person who's angry about things.
Well, he's
justifiably so.
Justifiably so,
yes.
And I mean, he's speaking for more than himself. He's speaking for the bald Catalonian in Manchester. He's also speaking for the retired professor from North London. People who have brought this up for years.
Yeah, well, okay. Enough with the guessing game. We'll talk about it later in the red card. What a show. I mean, just what a show. These conference finals for MLS were phenomenal. I hereby love the single elimination format. It just seems to add something unique and interesting and exciting and nerve-wracking to all of these games. I'm going to talk about that. We have a little bit on what turned out to be a pretty eventful Carabao Cup set of
do the drop. Do
right.
People want the drop?
Down. What people you want?
Literally everyone asks if we talk Carabao League Cup and don't do the drop.
You have a mailbag, right?
I have a mailbag that I haven't forwarded the contents.
No, I don't but know
but
a
I think
single one.
A lot of them are quite reactive. They're quite intuitive. They're kind of pop, 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 which is very much you as a broadcaster.
Yeah.
Off the cuff, off the shoulder.
That's how I operate. Let's see. MLS Cup final is set, JJ, and what do you know? It's going to be Toronto FC and Seattle Sounders. Once again, two upsets. We can debate, I guess, which upset we thought was bigger than the other.
I think
I would tend to say that
Toronto, I would think.
Yeah, even though I think LAFC was the best team in the league. Not think. They were. They were the best team in the league this season. I think there's really no question about that. But I don't know. We both spoke about Seattle when we were previewing that game, and there was kind of a side of us. You actually picked them. I still thought LAFC would win. I thought it would just come in extra time or penalties. But we both thought that Seattle could go in there and really give them a game. I don't know. Maybe we should have given Toronto a little bit more credit than we did.
I give them lots of credit. And I just said that I didn't think the way they played against NYCFC, which set the base for the win in that conference semifinal, was doable away to a team as good as Atlanta. And it really wasn't. But Lady Luck, oh, she was a smiling down.
Well.
Ah, she was, Andrew. If that goes 2-0, it's goodnight delights.
But is it, like, to me, it's luck if the keeper dives the wrong way and it's like a John Terry missed penalty at the end of the Champions League. The keeper saved that penalty. It was an amazing save.
Westberg had a brilliant game.
Yeah.
A brilliant game.
Like, I have a little bit of a hard time calling it luck.
No, but it's you know what I mean, though.
Yes.
Saved penalties are...
I know. Here's how the game essentially ended. What an incredible moment.
For Atlanta is Nagby. Pozuelo from Larea, who continues the run. Pozuelo into the middle. De Leon, Mullins trying to get himself back onside. Wrestle able to turn De Leon around. Now De Leon, Mullins flies, scores! Nick De Leon! Magic in the playoffs! And Toronto have come from behind to take the lead!
Now, I will have more on him specifically later on in the show.
Yes.
So I don't want to necessarily go too deep on Nick De Leon because he'll get his time later in the show.
Don't
you worry about that.
Let's
start from the back and we'll work forward after that. And let's start with that goal because it's one of the great moments of this season. It's one of the most memorable moments, I think you'd have to say, in league history. For him to score a goal like that in an upset like that in Atlanta to get his team to the MLS Cup final, it was truly a moment for the league. And the way that goal transpired, like, I can only put myself in the mind of an Atlanta United FC fan as that is happening. And I think I would be up screaming at every one of those players saying, somebody step up. Like, where are you all going? Step up. Move forward. Like, you could see it happening. And no one did anything. And De Leon just thought, well, if no one's going to step up and defend me, I'm just going to shoot this thing. And what a goal it was.
The strike was sublime. It was beyond Guzan. He's not getting to it. But Nick De Leon turned in a similar turning arc to the Titanic. He took all his sweet, sweet time because union rules demanded that Julian Gressel and that other defender from Atlanta decided, uh-oh, it's time to... We've gone with him halfway. Not our responsibility now. Halfway through his turn, they stopped and watched him and gazed upon his beauty. And he fired one into the top corner. Like, if I'm an Atlanta United fan, I love Julian Gressel. And he's a fantastic...
He played a great game. It's just a...
Ah, come on.
Just a moment for him.
Ah, moment.
He passed him off thinking, okay, well, this is where... I guess if this is some sort of zonal marking, he is now leaving my zone. And I think it was Leandro Gonzalez-Pires who it looked like was probably the next guy in line to take over. But no one... It was a lack of all communication. It was mental breakdowns all over the place. And it just...
Like, no.
I don't think De Leon ever... I don't think that move ever began with him thinking, I'm going to shoot here. He just felt like he had been left with no choice.
He's keeping the ball. He's trying to keep the move alive. And it was actually one of Toronto's few good moves of that second half. Let's be honest. They worked the ball. They kept it. Nick De Leon runs into a blind corner with Gressel and whoever the other defender was, who was really getting off the hook. And he turns. He turns not to shoot. He turns just to keep the ball and see what his options are. And suddenly it opens up like Moses and the Red Sea. There's this massive gap and there's only Guzan to beat. I say only. He sticks it right in the top bin. So credit to him for the strike. But that's just, if you're somebody like Frank de Boer watching that, you're going crazy.
I know.
Absolutely crazy. If you're going to go out with something you could do very little about.
And that's the thing. I'm glad you bring up Frank de Boer because he's had a kind of a topsy-turvy year, which started so poorly and then, I mean, got back on track in an incredible way to a point where Atlanta were basically viewed as the favorites to at least get to the final.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't know how you can really watch last night's game. I'm sure that there are people who are more tactically, you know, of the tactical mind than I am that could tell you what he did or didn't do wrong. But, like, you see something like that and, it just can't – people are so quick to blame the manager for things. I can't look at that and say that Frank de Boer did something wrong. Like, these are professionals.
I know.
Like, these are guys that just – you need to know. Your manager can't do everything for you.
But like I said early on, like, I thought Atlanta were playing within themselves in the conference, in the playoff games in general. And I thought at some point they're going to explode. And they just seem – and it's there for anyone to see. They just seem a little restricted from last season in the way that they play. For example – they were a team last season that could find gaps and find passes between the lines. And they did against Toronto. Toronto were very generous. Greg Vanney actually changed things at halftime. And it shored up things in front of Mavinga and the rest of that defence. But Frank de Boer, if you look at how they created their chances in the first half, the two chances, the goal was just a ball over the top. You know, it wasn't just a ball. It was a ball that split the defence. And then somehow Michael Bradley is the one chasing Pity Martinez, which is the last thing that you want, and he squares to Gressel. That was a good goal. But there were so many gaps and spaces. The penalty was just a ball over the top. There were two or three balls in the first half which they just belted long. It wasn't like intricate play. And the next thing they're in. And I'm like, just keep doing that. Keep doing that. Toronto can't handle it. It could have been 3-0. They could have been 3-0 down at half time. Didn't happen. Vanney made a change. Toronto looked much more compact in the second half. And they began to look like, at the very least, they were taking this to the... They were going to take it the distance. But they didn't look like they had a goal threat. And that's why that last goal is going to be so frustrating. What I would say is I'm not sure... I think we knew Atlanta United's identity under Tata Martino. And I think Barco, Pity Martinez, Joseph Martinez would flourish more in that system. I don't know who they are under Frank de Boer. Frank de Boer said it beforehand. You know, he talked about a single elimination and he was asked about it and he said, look, the best team will get through. If you think the best teams are going out, maybe they're not good enough, which was prophetic for Atlanta.
I wonder if he still thinks that.
Well, there we go.
Yeah. You know, it was kind of nice. Greg Vanney, after the match, in his interview, he was so effusive for how hard his team played, and he kind of deflected any attention that may have been on him off of himself to his players. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but he said something to the effect of, you know, like, this is what the power of passion and, like, you know, basically all the things that are anti-tactics, just, you know, this is what happens when you just outwork your opponent over the course of 90 minutes.
And, you know, the statisticians and the analysts in the game wouldn't subscribe to that view, but I think in a single elimination game away from home where you've got to grind it out and pull something out of a hat against the odds, passion is going to matter massively. And I think when we talk about Seattle and LAFC, that was a crucial point in that game too.
Yeah, and we will get to that. Before we do, I did want to ask you about, I mean, it almost feels inconsequential now because of how things played out, but the decision for Michael Bradley and the penalty. Now, it's one of those interesting ones where you have one camp saying, oh, not a penalty. And you have another camp saying, penalty, should have been red carded, would have changed the entire match.
Like, I think once the referee makes the decision, Alan Kelly, that it's a penalty, then he's got to go. Either that or it's not a...
No argument could be made that he's making some attempt to play the ball and that can therefore mitigate the red
card. If I remember, his arm comes down across the shoulder of Martinez and his foot comes across to try and nip it away. Maybe that's what Alan Kelly saw. I don't know. It's a tricky one.
It is. And if you're an Atlanta fan today, it's hard to stomach that because you're right. If it is a penalty, then what you're saying, you're not the only one saying if it's a penalty, it's a red card. But I don't know. Part of me wonders. So it's the 10th minute and it's already 1-0. And if you're the referee, I mean, you're now kind of deciding who's going to the conference finals. Like, am I really going to give them what, in that moment, he believes is a second goal and take a man off on a play that is dangerously close?
Yeah, and now, I guess he didn't want to do that. But for Atlanta, I don't think the fans can feel terribly sore about that. They got the penalty. They did not convert the penalty. And there was how many minutes left in the game to close this out?
Roughly 80.
Come on. This is not... I think if you're an Atlanta fan sitting at home, you know, annoyed about the referee not sending Michael Bradley off, who, by the way, was being overrun anyway. The penalty was a symptom of him not being absolutely overrun in midfield. You know, I think you want him to remain on the field, if I'm being honest with you.
Well, I don't know about that. I think you prefer to be a man up.
I think Vanney recognised it at halftime and had to make a change to make things more compact and tight. It was a good save, but Joseph Martinez, I mean, he has a lot of missed penalties. For all the penalties he scores, he has plenty of them. Now, they usually come when he does that little hop thing. But he didn't do that.
Now, Frank de Boer did reveal after the match that Joseph Martinez is playing hurt, which we always knew was a possibility when he injured himself late in the regular season. You know, there was always going to be a question of just how healthy he was during the postseason. And how true it is, I don't know. But Frank de Boer is saying that Joseph Martinez is playing hurt. I don't know. He looked pretty good against Philadelphia.
He didn't look bad last night either, to be honest with you. It was a case of converting your chances.
They had their chances. They did not convert them to the extent that they needed to, and now they are out. And it is, and it's pretty shocking. Toronto now ties Seattle, Sporting Kansas City, and the Chicago Fire for the fifth most MLS Cup appearances all time. And I guess with that, we will go into one of those teams that they have now tied for that distinction, and that is the Seattle Sounders, who go into L.A. and come away 3-1 winners. Wow. Just wow. So many props to them. As we've been saying, it's hard to be, over the course of not just this season, but I think the last few seasons, it's hard to be both as good as they have been while simultaneously being as underrated as they have been. Like, when we talk MLS and great teams and things like that over the last few seasons, it's Atlanta, it's Toronto, you know, it for brief moments last year, it was like DC United. It's not, you know, it's just not typically Seattle, and yet they're always there. And here they are once again.
I think it's because in the middle of the season, they have a kind of a slump, or a period where you're like, Seattle aren't going that well. And it kind of twists narratives on us, and we ignore them a little bit.
They were the second seed in the conference.
I know, but I think...
And they have pedigree, like we've talked about. Like, they've done this. They've been there. They've lifted this trophy.
Do you not think this league, certainly in the last few seasons, its attention has been swayed by shiny things?
Absolutely.
I think Toronto were a shiny thing in the season that they won, and they set these records and we were focused on them. And then Atlanta comes in and that's another kind of shiny thing because they're good straight away and they've got these young South American talents. Then you have LAFC and they come in and we're like, wow. Even last year they were really good at times and they've got a shiny thing. And then the Galaxy have a shiny thing. And hey, New York are better under Dome Tarrant. They're kind of shiny. Wayne Rooney at DC United, shiny. Whereas if you look at the lack of shine in the Seattle team, but you look at the experience and the playoff nous, it's better than almost any team.
And I think we have to talk about Brian Schmetzer as well. I saw this stat, and it's pretty amazing. Since Schmetzer took over, first on an interim and then on a permanent basis, the Sounders have averaged 1.69 points per game in 116 league matches, and it only gets better in the MLS Cup playoffs, where Seattle's points per game is up to 2.19 over 16 games while keeping 9 clean sheets since 2019. I mean, remember, he came in midseason and got them their title, and there has been very little drop-off since. And he has them buying in wholeheartedly to this style of, we don't need to possess the ball. You know, we can defend. We can out-defend teams. We'll be well-organized. We'll be great on the counterattack, which was totally the case in this one. And they have rode that all the way to another final appearance.
We talked about passion as well. He has instilled that in this team. From early on, there's no point not mentioning the referee. The referee was for the Seattle LAFC game was trapped in 1995. Everything was allowed. He was so permissive. And Seattle were up for that. They were ready for it. And LAFC were not. Which was surprising to me that a Bob Bradley team that had overcome its great kind of demon in Zlatan and LA Galaxy through no little fight in that game themselves would then fall foul of a team that was pumped to the gills with fight.
Yeah, here are what the goals sounded like in this one.
Rui Diaz gave his marker the slip and equalises. Now it's Lodeiro. And Lodeiro has turned this game on its head. Here's Rui Diaz. He has a chance. He scored! And he swept Seattle to within touching distance of an appearance yet again at MLS Cup.
There was a moment in the game that summed up everything. It's the 85th minute and it's 3-1 and LAFC are, they think with the talent they have, if they can grab one, grandstand finished, they'll get another. They might get it. They'll definitely get another few chances. And Atuesta has the ball in midfield and he's looking up. And straight away, he's tackled by Brad Smith. And the next thing, Brad Smith's won the ball. Atuesta's on his backside looking at the referee for a foul. And Brad Smith is hearing down the wing on the left-hand side, looking to centre. And he should have too. I think it was... who was making that run? I'm not even sure who it was that was making the run, but he didn't. He got cut out. And it's like 85 minutes left. Seattle have all the running, all the passion, all the heart. This is how they got it done. Quick counterattacks. That plus LAFC posted a season low expected goals. And you could see it. They just weren't creating the chances with the same frequency as in previous games in the season. You add in bad defending, Andrew. Look at, I think it was the second goal for Seattle, the go-ahead goal. Edge of the box. It was not quite a carbon copy of De Leon's goal for Toronto, but it wasn't far off it. And you're like, who's closing them down? Nobody.
And with the form that he's in, you just, like, Raul Rui Diaz cannot have any space right now, or he'll kill you. So. And it happened with his first goal, and it was a little bit of a fortuitous bounce. But he made that happen, and his finish was brilliant. Lodeiro as well, a goal and two assists. His goal, perfect finish in a spot where the keeper wasn't going to be able to get it. I mean, these two guys now, JJ, in Seattle Sounders history, Nicholas Lodeiro now has 7 goals. That is the most in the history – playoff goals. That's the most in the history of the club. And Rui Diaz has all of a sudden tied Clint Dempsey for second with 6 playoff goals for Seattle. Like, these two guys have created this thing here with Jordan Morris, and they have become lethal on the counterattack. It can be fun to watch.
You look at the midfield of Bob Bradley, Blessing, attacking player, Atuesta, attacking player, Lee Wynn. Where's the steal there? Look at the Seattle midfield. You had Svensson, Roldan. You had Ladero dropping in. You had Morris. You had Jones dropping in. You also had Rui Diaz getting in the mix as well to create that, just basically outnumber that Los Angeles midfield, win the ball, go on the attack. Schmetzer got it right, and I think people out there who think in a single elimination game you are duty bound by the soccer gods to put on some kind of special display that the purists will love. Sorry,
I didn't hate watch this.
I didn't hate it either.
No,
but
this was a fine watch.
Again, I'm channeling the fans. Somebody tweeted that the two most offensive teams are now in the final.
Offensive?
Defensive.
Oh.
The two teams that could defend are in the final. Talk about LAFC's regular season record all you want, Andrew. The playoffs, they have not been good.
And it makes me wonder if they will have to change a little bit in order to take that next step.
You take me back. Weren't Bob Bradley, U.S. men's national teams, noted for being stingy? Weren't they well organized? Weren't they a little less on the, little more on the unspectacular side of things?
Well, yeah, but they might have been, like, had they been what LAFC are to MLS, he might have played a little bit differently.
Fair.
I think some of that is out of necessity.
Fair, okay. All right. How dare you shoot me down.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't want to tell Bob Bradley that what he did this season was wrong. I mean, look how good they were. Like, it's a little bit Monday morning quarterback for us to sit here and say, this was wrong with them, this was wrong with them, this was wrong.
You,
they were a great team, and it's single elimination.
You just admitted they need to change, though, and I would agree with that. They're going to have to be a bit more robust. And that might not mean...
Well, we've said all season long that they have an issue defensively. And in the wrong moment of a single elimination format, that could bite them.
Yeah.
And it did. And so here we are. It is now once again, incredibly, Seattle and Toronto FC. Before we move on from Seattle, I was just talking about Brian Schmetzer. I've fallen in love with him, and I want to spend an afternoon with him. I just want to know what it is that makes him tick. Like, he just seems like such an interesting character to me. His on-field interview after the game, I just loved every second of it. And by the way, for the people who think that these, like, post-game interviews on the field right after are worthless, like,
sometimes they are.
Think of what Bob Bradley did to Seb Salazar, and then this interview with Brian Schmetzer in the next game. Like, they're giving us great stuff.
Coach, a lot of intensity in this building. How are you feeling after that match?
I feel a lot better than Bob. I mean, you know,
why do you say that?
Well, because, you know, one team has to sell. We did it last year. We had Portland celebrating on our home field. So I know what Bob's going through, and it's not a good feeling. We use that as motivation for this playoff run this year. So I get it. It's winners and losers, and these playoff formats are great for the league. And, you know, I'm just so proud of these guys out there and the people up there. The tactics were right. Their effort was right. Their mentality was right, and they deserve to win the game.
How did you do it?
Well, I'll let Bobby Warsaw tell me how I did it.
What makes this group special, Coach?
Well, because they never quit. We went down 1-0 to the best. And look, they had the best regular season ever. This is a tremendous team. Bob's a great coach. But we came out, went down a goal, and came back and scored 3 in their home. So you guys tell me if my team deserves some credit.
I think they do. Thanks, Coach. Appreciate the time. Go enjoy it.
Ah, golly gee. What a tough game that was out there. And you tell Bob, I thought he did a fine job, a great job. And we're going to be still fighting for this title.
His subtle. There was nothing subtle about the shot he took at Bobby Warsaw there.
No.
And I love it because anytime one of these managers or players, when they tell you, oh, I don't pay attention to what the media says, liar. You all pay attention.
The weird thing about it is, though, is that this is an MLS manager who is paid by the league, paid by his club, paid by the league, and Bobby is also an MLS guy who's paid by, you know, like...
Yeah, but he's
no, but
like,
it's so in-house, you know what I mean?
I know, but he's considered media.
He is, but it just reminds me of how kind of parochial U.S. soccer is. Like, you're not far from anybody in if you're in the firmament of U.S. soccer, you know everyone. It's really like, and he's paying attention to the guy on the MLS website,
and
that's not to downgrade what Bobby does. It's great.
No, I think he's excellent.
He's great.
And he's entitled to his opinions, but of course.
But like to your point, coaches, managers, players, There are some individuals who do not pick up a paper, but those are the guys who are usually killing it.
But
killing it. The guys who are under pressure are definitely reading the papers.
I guess Bobby Warshaw, he's kind of been, I don't know if trolling is too strong, but he has not been super high on Seattle. And he basically said leading into this that they'll have to play scared to win. And I wouldn't say that that was what they did. And I think Bobby Warshaw, if you read his stuff afterwards where he acknowledged all this, he kind of just took it on the chin.
You look at the first, I think it was, as Pep Guardiola would say, one of the first actions in the game was for Diego Rossi to get the ball and try to beat a Seattle defender, only to run right into the midfield of three more Seattle defenders. And I was like, it's going to be a rough night for LAFC. If they think this is how soft-centered Seattle are, no.
Yeah. Last but not least, I just can't help but wonder how LAFC's season will be remembered. I mean, obviously, this will be their defining moment, unfortunately, but we do have to remember most points in a season with 72, highest goal differential in a season at plus 48, and the previous record was plus 41, which had stood since 1998, and yeah, they just crushed that. Tied for the most goals in the season with 85.
Look, it depends how you view the regular season. If you're like me, you view the regular season as a vessel to get you to the postseason. No more than that. Mm-hmm. And so I look at them as a team that a lot of talk, a lot of hype, a good side, but ultimately failed at the penultimate hurdle. That's how I look at them. Now, there's other people who see it differently and who put much more on the regular season. And I, again, one of the reasons I don't put a lot in the regular season is there's too many teams get in. Like, you know, you can be fairly crap for a good portion of the season and still get in. But there's people who are more tuned to this system than I am, particularly in MLS. And Pablo Moore on Twitter, who writes for The Athletic, I generally love the playoffs, but the idea that LAFC losing in the conference finals makes them not the greatest team in MLS history is laughable. They fully redefined expectations at multiple levels for an MLS club. Dominant team guided by an MLS all-time most talented player. So that's one way of looking at it. If you want to applaud Carlos Vela and the season he had, if you want to applaud Bob Bradley and the team he put together, like, the stats are there for you.
I mean, and Carlos Vela should waltz to an MVP.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they have so much talent, and so sometimes that hurts a manager's ability to win Manager of the Year. But if you look at LAFC and you look at some of their key players, like Marc-Anthony Kay, Latif Blessing, like, these are not necessarily guys that you looked at before the year and were like, oh, yeah, this team is loaded. So I think Bob Bradley should probably waltz to a Manager of the Year accolade as well. So, yeah, it's hard for, you're right, in a single elimination, it's hard for me to look at this and say, you know, nope, failure, bad season. I'm sure that's how they'll probably look at it, that this was a failure, because their goal is to be champions, and that's not going to be the case. I mean, look, the one thing that comes out of this is that, like, they just do have to be better in defense. Going back to last season, they've got three MLS playoff games, all of them at home, and they've given up three goals in each of them. That's not good enough.
I think the easiest way to address that is by beefing up that midfield. I think, like I said, it has the consistency of a soft cheese. You can get through it too easy, and then you get at a back line, which is not great.
Fascinating stuff. So Seattle and Toronto, I can't help but wonder. We'll have time to preview this. It's not till November 10th when the championship will be played out in Seattle. Jozy Altidore, I do wonder very much whether or not he will be good to go.
I wonder that.
This has like a Harry Kane Champions League final feel to it.
Or Diego Costa night 2014, yeah. Was it? I think it was 2014, when everyone's like, he's got to start. Substitution
after 9 minutes?
Yeah. So in my view, I don't think I'd start him, regardless. I mean,
what, are you a doctor? You've been examining him.
Sorry, excuse me. Don't get so snippy with me. There was an MRI, basically.
And you've reviewed it.
Toronto gave out last night. They didn't give it out. They didn't hand out copies of it. But they said, we took an MRI and he's not even close for this game. So I'm wondering how much he will make that up in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, muscle injuries are tricky. It's going to be fun. These teams have a history. They certainly have a history. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got a mailbag. We've got a what to watch for. We've got red cards, man of the match. The fun continues. Don't go anywhere. Back now on Caught Offside.
An unheralded star of last night was Dylan Miskiewicz, who popped up in ads for Zip Recruiter.
Yeah, like he's popped up in our ads for Zip Recruiter.
I know, but I hadn't seen his face before.
So you thought this whole time I was just making him up, that he was not a real person.
I did not know.
That involves him and his wife getting divorced because of a yoga instructor.
Kenneth. I would like to abandon that now, knowing that Dylan is a real person. But I would also like to tell you that ZipRecruiter is great.
Let's see. You know what else is great? The mailbag, JJ.
At CEO SoccerPod on Twitter, at CaughtOffside ESPN on Instagram, CaughtOffsidePod@gmail.com. You can contact us there. Also, you should write a review for us on iTunes. There has been some very nice ones, and I think I'm going to start reading them.
Oh, wow.
As part of the mailbag.
If there's one thing you love, it's reading high praise about this show.
And if they're, if they're amusing and they tickle my fancy, they'll get read. Brody starts off.
It's a good American name.
Oh, it's solid, isn't it?
Yeah.
Brody.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see him. Blonde, flowing hair, rippling muscles. Sense of pride in his nation, in a cornfield.
He just stays in the cornfield.
He doesn't,
can't leave.
Can't leave.
It's an electric fence.
that's the symbol we need. A few people wanted us to talk, not just Brody. There was one or two more people, about the USL Championship and Pittsburgh Riverhounds' improved chances of winning it. They won 7-0 at home on Saturday night against Birmingham Legion FC, which gives them a big bump in 538's playoff projections, making the Hounds the clear favourite to advance in the Eastern Conference after this weekend's conference quarterfinals. So, well done to them. They feel as if we don't talk enough about them. They feel as if when we talk about USL, we talk about, you know.
Well, we've talked about Phoenix.
Yes.
Who are in action tomorrow.
Right. But we have not mentioned the Riverhounds in a while. So there you go. Do you think Leicester are considered to be in the title race? I use this term loosely, as Liverpool seem to be on their own planet. That's from another listener, Andrew.
Well, look, I mean, I'll give this to you in its simplest form. Are Chelsea in the title race?
No.
Okay. Well, them and Leicester are tied on points.
Okay.
So, and I know there's more to it than just that.
Yeah, there is.
But to me, no, they're not in the title race. That doesn't mean I don't think incredibly highly of them. It doesn't mean that I don't think they can finish top four this season.
I find it curious that we're doing this in October. I really do.
Really? I've pronounced Liverpool title winners for weeks now.
No, I think we need to add in people who are in a potential title race in early January. See how they survive and weather the winter.
I mean,
yeah,
technically, yes, you're right. And like, it will all bear itself out. But that's part of what we do here, is like speculate.
Yeah, gotcha. Pepe Ponders. Hey, fellas. Huge fan of the pod, as well as a fan of Peaky Blinders. If you were a blinder yourself in 1920s Birmingham, who would you rather have on your football team for a game of pickup? Now, I've got a real problem with these selections here. The Gerrard-like maestro Tommy Shelby, who can control and bend a game to his plan and is always thinking one step ahead, or the Roy Keane-like brute of Arthur Shelby, known for his aggressions and willingness to take on any tackle or opponent to protect his team family. Now, let me speak in defence of Roy, just for one second. I don't think Pepe has ever seen Roy play. In terms of trophies and winning and success, he's far more like Tommy Shelby. Far more like Tommy Shelby.
Yeah.
And he was a playmaker himself, and he conducted the play. He was one of the best midfielders in Europe. So Gerrard and McKean, you'd want, it needs, the Arthur Shelby character that's a footballer needs to be a bit more bumbling.
Arthur Shelby, he's too much of a red card waiting to happen.
Yeah, right.
I'm a big Aberama Gold guy.
Yeah.
His kind of like quiet shiftiness.
Yeah, and his accent, which is weird. It's not quite Irish.
That guy's a great actor.
He is. Aidan Gillen.
Yeah, he's been in Game of Thrones, been in The Wire.
Yeah. Also, at the start of The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, he's in the plane that crumples.
Yeah. With Bane.
Different accent in everything he's in.
Right.
Never speaks the same. Like, he's like Gary Oldman.
He is a bit.
I still am not quite sure what Gary Oldman's true voice is.
I think it's more London than we ever thought. It's more, knees up, Mrs. Brown. How's it going?
Oh, my God.
I think it's a bit more.
Yeah, that's what Gary Oldman sounds like.
Gary Oldman also stars in a very good, one of the early, I say very good. He hams it up so much. This is a weird film. I got to look it up. I think it's called The Firm. I'm not sure. But it's one of the early hooligan films. And it's a young Gary Oldman who plays a West Ham fan. I'll dig that up for you guys. Annie is an Indian expat who wanted to share his story for following Man United. Maybe you can discuss this sometime in the next 5 years if someone else has a similar story. Growing up in a cricket-crazy country of India, I knew of two football players until 1998, Pele and Maradona, just because they are who they are. My brother and I started playing football and became United fans only because of the 1998 World Cup and the coverage the average Indian newspaper's media had of David Beckham. The media built him up as the greatest thing ever. As naive boys who just started watching football, we just followed the club Beckham played for also. My female friends had a huge crush on the guy, and that added to the enigma of Beckham, and we were just hooked on football. Within a year of following United, I had started enjoying the league. Favourite players included Giggs, Bergkamp, Owen, as much as I hated Liverpool, along with my Beckham. And I did, did I forget mentioning winning the treble? That cemented my love for United. The reason I'm saying all this is I just want to highlight the importance of a larger-than-life character needed to make football popular. Cristiano Ronaldo, Lionel Messi don't just wow us who enjoy football, but they also make football popular globally. I know of at least four football fans in my family in India who got into football only because of Ronaldo and Messi. It seems that we cover teams a lot on your podcast, but I just want to shout out to the supreme importance of the superstar to make sure that the sport gains popularity, especially in places where football following is not natural. I would agree with that, but I would counter that a little bit. You lived and grew up in India. I know some players that went out there and played in the Indian Super League in soccer. Indian sports fans are psychotic. They love it. Absolutely love it. And they love, he's right about hooking onto the celebrity side of things, but they do love just good players. And they've supported the teams in the Indian Super League pretty amazingly. So, yeah. And I guess in America too, a lot of people follow a player like Neymar. There's the Neymar stands out there.
Yeah, of course.
But not necessarily a team. Andrew, you know when we do a podcast and you hear back from some listeners and you begin to question what you said? Well, this is from Lee, so we should give him a nice intro.
Hey, Lee.
So I got this the other day, and I don't know. For everything you denied regarding Craig Burley's rant about over-the-top Americans blowing out of proportion the Pulisic and USA situation, you followed up with that pod about how great America is now and what a world-beater Pulisic is. You say so much about what he deserves, etc., assuming you have scouts at training daily to see that too.
I believe I addressed that directly, saying that we have to defer to Frank Lampard because he is seeing training and we are not.
But yeah.
Continue.
That's it.
Literally, like, go back and word for word.
But do people not get, like, what we're doing?
Maybe they didn't think that the, like, when I play that song, America is Back.
Yeah.
You know that's a parody, right? That, I took that from South Park. That's not real.
And when
that's a joke.
And when I say, oh, America's back, baby, I don't mean it. I also go on to slag off Walker Zimmerman and the U.S. defense for Sergiño Dest choosing them over De Ligt and Virgil van Dijk and everything else. There's a lot of joking and humor in what we do here.
But also, we are fans, if nothing else, and we are allowed to get excited when stuff like that happens. Like, Christian Pulisic scoring a hat-trick for Chelsea was a cool moment for people who have supported him since he was, like, 16 years old.
And how does that relate to what Craig Burley said?
Whatever,
what
man.
What we said about Craig Burley was, like, we don't think we're world beaters, by the way. Never thought that. Don't believe it. But we believe we should be at least competitive against Canada.
Right.
Or able to beat them. And also,
he needs to go back and re-listen to things.
Yeah.
I think so much of he's pushing his own narrative.
But yeah, but
that
seems to happen a lot when we say something. Someone takes that bit. It's like they pause the podcast, don't listen to any context, and then come at us.
We said about the Craig Burley thing. We're not asking the U.S. to go over to Europe and beat England and France and go down to South America and beat Brazil and Argentina. We're asking them to be competitive against Canada and not recede into a shell.
Yeah.
I mean, Canada hadn't beaten the U.S. in what, 30 years? Like, we're not asking for the world.
No. We're asking
I
know.
I've had it
with him. Thanks, Lee, for that. Vanessa wants to know why we never talked about Colleen Rooney and Rebecca Vardy's WAG saga. I guess we should have talked about it.
Should we have?
I don't know. It's kind of in our wheelhouse, isn't it? Bit of fun.
Have at it.
Well, so Colleen Rooney, basically using Columbo-style skills, Colleen they're calling her, to discover that someone on her private Instagram had been leaking stuff to the papers. And she wasn't sure who it was. So she put up, over the course of a year, a series of clearly false stories. And she had a hunch that it was Rebecca Vardy. So she blocked everyone from seeing these stories except Rebecca Vardy. And all these stories ended up in The Sun, according to Colleen. And so she puts up on her Instagram or Twitter this kind of, you know, almost like Cluedo-esque lead-in, and then says it was Rebecca Vardy, which launched a whole, you know, load of memes, including my favorite on the internet, which was Wagatha Christie.
Nice.
Agatha Christie Wagner. All right. And finally, Andrew, you didn't enjoy that at all. Wow. Tony wants to know...
Never going to fake it, all right?
Who you guys are dressing up for? Dressing up as for Halloween?
What a loser. I don't have a costume this year. You just dropped that on me.
But you can you can tell of previous years.
Well, okay. I mean, long-time listeners know that my greatest costume was when I went as Gene Shalit, the 80s/90s heavyweight...
Stick
movie
merchant.
Critic on NBC. I'm quite fond of his work. Maybe we'll post a picture later.
Yeah.
Last year I went as like a 1940s pilot.
Okay. I'm going out tonight as Takashi 69.
Oh my God. You better be careful.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of that.
If you're too convincing and the wrong person sees you.
Do you think?
I mean, he's like, isn't he in witness protection?
Not yet, no, but people have gone to prison already.
Look, I care about you. I don't want anything bad to happen to you. Go with something else.
Don't go as Tekashi 69.
Come, go with something else, yeah.
Oh, it's a bit late in the day.
He just ratted out like every gang member in the city.
I know, but I'm not him, clearly.
We'll find out how good the costume is.
Oh, boy.
Is that it for the mailbag?
Oh, it could be it for me.
Let's hope not. Because I so love our time together. What to watch for?
You said that with no sincerity.
I said that with all the sincerity of 1,000 suns.
Yeah.
Let's see. This weekend, JJ in the Premier League. Saturday, 8:30 a.m., Bournemouth and Manchester United. United coming off a really nice win over Chelsea.
What a goal by Marcus Rashford.
Yeah.
Brilliant free
Lots
kick.
Lots of Ronaldo comparisons flying through the ether.
That is, as Mourinho says, how he likes to kick the ball. Did you ever hear Mourinho talking about him? Marcus does the run, cut inside, and kicks it the way he likes.
I've heard him say this about everyone.
Heart and soul.
That's how they play. no, but a good win for United as they get past what had been an informed Chelsea side. And who knows? I mean, look... How United's season is going to ultimately be judged, I don't know. That's going to be in the eye of the beholder. But if they go on and win a cup, at least they'll be able to take something from it. So just,
yeah, but
as the Washington Nationals say, stay in the fight.
A point versus Liverpool, an away win at Norwich, and then an away win at Bournemouth would be a nice little run. And Jose Mourinho might even call it this remontada.
My favorite game of the weekend, JJ, Saturday at 11 a.m., Manchester City and Southampton. We're going to learn something about Southampton this weekend because they are coming off just the lashing of all
lashings.
What
are we going to learn?
They just lost 9-0 to Leicester. Now, we know what Manchester City have been capable of because they handed out a similar beating to Watford earlier this season. If it happens again, similarly, like a 6-0, I think you got to start considering taking drastic action with the manager. I need Southampton to show me at least something that what happened that 9-0 that happened to them last week, that like it hurt their pride in a way that they will do whatever they can to make sure it doesn't happen again, regardless of who they're playing against. I don't care that it's Man City. Not saying they have to win it. They can't get embarrassed.
Are they going to do what Craig Levein did for Scotland? Against Spain, where he played, what was the formation he played? Like, it was like 7-3-0. Oh,
that crank. Would show me something.
Yeah,
if they just line up 11 men in the goal, so, like maybe a couple on each other's shoulders.
Remember 17th century wars, battles where people would just line up. They'd have a row of cannon and a row of horses, and yeah, like that.
Muskets and such.
Yeah, this is the insight people come to this podcast for.
Saturday, 11 a.m., Arsenal and Wolves, both bowing out of the Carabao Cup.
I mean, there's ways of doing it. I saw Tim Spears, who we had on the podcast in the club for Wolves, saying, hey guys, calm down, Wolves are out, but we're doing really well in Europe for the first time in like 40 years that we've been in there, and we're fighting on a Premier League front. We can't do three things.
Yeah.
So I kind of understand that, but Arsenal and Liverpool.
What can you even say about that game other than Sonic? I think Steve Nicol put it best when I think he said, I've never been so entertained by a reserve match.
Why can't he say anything without the snark? Come on,
that's
Steve.
Who he is.
Yeah, I know. Fine, reserve game. You still had Mesut Ozil on the field.
What a game.
Winning tackles, Andrew. Not looking like a man who's been sat on his sofa playing Fortnite for the last month.
I enjoyed his assist.
Oh, the one for Maitland-Niles.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Little back heel. Yeah.
Ox scores another banger. And then Willock runs down the field and belts one into the top corner. And Kevin Kelleher, whose head must have been spinning after conceding 5 goals in 90 minutes, comes up big and saved the penalty. That was a brilliant game.
It was really fun to watch.
I'll tell you what, so what if the League Cup becomes... like we had a listener, it didn't make the mail, but why are we even having the League Cup? Why do we? That's why we're having it. Why wouldn't you want that?
Yeah, I mean, look, it gives some of these managers a chance to rotate their squad, to play some of their fringe players like Divock Origi and like Mesut Ozil, who apparently now is a reserve player for Arsenal.
Off after
but he's alive.
Hour. Well, yeah, but I think the plan... We didn't mention this last weekend, and we should. Emery kind of said that there was an agreement between him and the Arsenal board that Ozil would not be in matchday squads and starting anymore for league games. Crazy.
I would like more of an explanation as to why that would be. But yeah, this was an incredibly entertaining watch. This from Opta: Liverpool versus Arsenal is the highest scoring fixture in the history of the League Cup, not yesterday, but overall, with 47 goals scored in the 15 meetings between them. Also, Liverpool have won 8 penalty shootouts in the League Cup, more than any other team in the competition's history. It's funny that this happened when it did, because what did I just say after the Liverpool-Tottenham game a few days ago? That if Tottenham had scored 7 goals, Liverpool would have found a way to score 8. That happened in this game basically just a few days later.
Yeah,
Arsenal scored 5, and Liverpool found a way to still beat them on penalties.
Other people were asking, is it a regular occurrence that a scoreline in regular minutes will outscore the penalty kicks? There'll be more goals in the penalty kicks usually than there would be in the regular game.
Yes.
Well, Champions League final 2005, that goes against it. That was 3-3, 3-2 on penalties. It's actually more usual than you would think.
Interesting. Before we leave this one, I did want to mention that there's a report out there. How valid it is, I don't know, but a report that Jose Mourinho would potentially be interested in managing Arsenal, and I'm just curious if he would maybe be the right man for the job.
Not without investment that Arsenal aren't prepared to make. I can't see Mourinho.
Well, I guess the one thing that I keep thinking about is Arsenal's greatest weakness is their defending.
Yeah, but do you think
maybe he could in some way
organize that defense with that personnel?
Look, there's a player in Mustafi that is just begging to come out, okay?
Yeah, maybe. I think it would be one of the great tests of his organizational skills. It would fly in the face. What a slap in the face it would be to everything that Arsene Wenger built. Everything.
That's a great point. Having said all this, I don't view Unai Emery as someone being on the chopping block right now.
For the fans, yes. For Stan Kroenke, no.
Okay.
That's the way I'd see it.
Sunday, 9 a.m., Crystal Palace and Leicester City. Probably two of the pleasant surprises this season. Leicester, I don't want to say that because we knew that they were a good team.
Yeah.
Crystal Palace, though, we did not expect what we're seeing. And this is going to be a really interesting test for them. And they've played well this season against some of the bigger sides in the league.
Yeah, they have. They're not going to be the most entertaining watch all the time. Their best player isn't even playing all that well, but they're still getting results.
Yeah.
So.
And then finally, JJ, Sunday at 11:30 a.m., the low morale derby as Everton hosts Spurs
at Goodison
in a battle of who can find rock bottom the quickest.
Wow. Are you going to watch it with your Everton friends?
No. I'm gonna turn down the lights, draw the shades, hide under a blanket, and just wait for something bad to happen.
Pour yourself a stiff drink. I have no idea how this one will go. I'd still fancy Tottenham.
So do I. I truly believe they're a better team. Now, it's at Goodison. We'll see what that could potentially yield. I mean, look, I don't want to mock Tottenham too much. They just lost to Liverpool. And it was close. So that's not, you know, that's not an embarrassing loss that they're coming off of. And if you look at Everton, the way that they just lost, I mean, it was in just like the craziest fashion on bizarre penalty decisions and terrible own goals. So, you know, who knows? You're right. I really have no idea how this one's going to go. Bring it down the stretch now. Let's do this.
Red card.
Would you like to go first?
Yeah. David Heitner in The Guardian reported this yesterday. Richard Keogh has been left distraught after Derby County sacked him on Wednesday. The club captain sustained serious knee ligament injuries when he was in the car that his teammate Tom Lawrence crashed into a lamppost after a boozy night out on the 24th of September. Keogh, 33, has had surgery and is expected to be out for 12 to 14 months, giving him a return date at the end of next year. His contract, under which he was paid £24,000 sterling a week, was set to expire in June 2020. Derby had told Keogh he could stay and see out his deal, yet they stunned the central defender by saying he had to accept a massive pay cut in order to do so. It is understood Derby offered him only a fraction of the money he would otherwise have collected over the remainder of his contract. The club's hardline stance was unacceptable to Keogh, and now they have told him he is no longer in their employ. Keogh has instructed his lawyers in the matter, and the Professional Footballers Association has also become involved. Keogh had been out with Lawrence and other Derby players, including Mason Bennett, after a team bonding day. Lawrence's car went into the back of Bennett's before going across a roundabout and hitting a lamppost. Keogh was left unconscious at the scene, and Lawrence and Bennett fled. They returned 45 minutes later when they were arrested. The men admitted drink driving and failing to stop at the scene of an accident when they appeared at Derby Magistrates Court on the 15th of October. They avoided jail sentences, but each was ordered to carry out 180 hours of unpaid community service and banned from driving for 2 years. Lawrence and Bennett were not in the Derby squad for the home win against Birmingham on the 28th of September, but Lawrence has played 90 minutes in all five of the club's subsequent matches. Bennett has been used twice as a substitute. Derby also fined both of them 6 weeks' wages. Now, when Derby released their statement that morning after what had happened that night, they did not name Lawrence or Bennett. They named Richard Keogh, the club captain. And the minute I saw that, it was a really tough, hardline statement to release. But the minute I saw that they named those two guys, or that they didn't name those two guys and named Richard Keogh, was interesting to me. And Aidan O'Hara, the Irish journalist, tweeted this. Not defending Richard Keogh's actions for a second, but Derby sacking the 33-year-old who is on £25,000 a week for the next 18 months, but keeping the two 20-somethings who are worth a few million each is a great example of how football ethics works. Now, I think the three of them should have had their contracts terminated, personally. But it just goes to show you the commodity the footballer is, how that depreciates over time, and how you look. Derby were struggling at the time. This was a club-sanctioned night out, by the way. Mm-hmm. The club had laid on cars for them, so I don't know why those guys were ending up in cars. But ultimately, this does fall on Derby County as well. And I think it's really cheap and wrong what they're doing to Richard Keogh, who has over 300-odd appearances for the club over 8 years, has only missed a handful of games in that time period. You know, I think he deserves more than this, or at least equal to what happened to the two guys who were actually convicted of drunk driving. He wasn't.
That's fair. That's a good one by you. JJ, my red card goes to the Carabao Cup fixture list. Oh. Here's why. Can you imagine if after a match like the 5-5 thriller they just had, that Liverpool's cup run ends on a forfeit against Aston Villa? Here's why I say that. I'm reading now from ESPN FC. A scheduling headache awaits both the EFL and Liverpool as the quarterfinal stage of the tournament is due to be played the week of December 16th, which is when Jurgen Klopp's men begin their Club World Cup campaign in Qatar. Here's what Jurgen said. He said, if they don't find a place for us, an appropriate place, not 3 a.m. on Christmas Day, then we don't play it. You have to think about these things. If you have a fixture list where one team can't be a part of all the games, then you have to think about the fixture list. Hopefully it starts now. I really think that's fair. This problem is obvious now. We will not be the victim of this problem. It's a good point by him. How can this happen? Here's Liverpool's December schedule, JJ. Features five matches in the first 2 weeks. Everton, December 4th. Bournemouth, December 7th. That's in the Premier League. Before going to Salzburg on December 10th. In the Champions League. Then they host Watford on December 14th. Then they go to Qatar. Their first match in Qatar is on December 18th. Then they'll play either the final or, yes, the third place game, which is a thing that exists in this tournament, so necessary, on December 21st, before returning to England for their December 26th match against Leicester City. This is madness.
Yep.
madness. I don't know how they're going to navigate this thing, and I don't know when this game against Aston Villa is going to get played.
Well, I think there's the precedent was set down by Sir Alex Ferguson 18 years ago when they pulled, 19 years ago now, when they pulled out of the FA Cup for the World Club Cup. They said, this is just too much. We're not playing in the FA Cup in January. And it wasn't even as congested a tight period of time for United then. They just said, we're not playing all these games. And some say that was the death of the FA Cup as we know it.
And look, it would be a little bit of a shame because I still don't believe, no matter where Liverpool get to in this tournament, maybe not the final, but I think he's going to continue playing a lot of these younger players, and it's a great opportunity for them to gain some like big match experience.
That could be another fun game.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So, yeah, it's terrible this is coming down the tracks. Hopefully this will bring this to a head. FIFA, UEFA, just piling
There's
in.
Too much football!
And it's not all good.
No.
Caught Offside's Man of the Match.
What do you got?
Thiago Motta, who was the manager of Genoa. Now, look, Genoa lost 2-1 last night, but this is from the weekend. They lost to Juventus. So this is from the weekend, and he deserves credit. Nicky Bandini in The Guardian. Thiago Motta could not coax 7 goals out of Genoa in his first game at the helm, but he did achieve something no other Serie A manager has ever done before, sending on 3 substitutes who all went on to score. Trailing 1-0 at home to Brescia, Motta introduced Kevin Agudelo at halftime, Goran Pandev after 58 minutes, and then Christian Kouame in the 65th. The last of those players hit the crossbar within seconds of entering the pitch. The first of them equalised a few moments after that. Signed from the Colombian club Atletico Huila in the summer, Agudelo had never made an appearance under Genoa's previous manager, Aurelio Andrazzoli. Motta's decision to offer him a debut here was justified as the player swept home a confident finish from Andrea Pinamonte's cut back inside the box. Kouame scored next, meeting Paolo Giglione's cross with a spectacular scissor kick. Their final goal came on the counter, Pandev exploiting the space left by an exhausted and overstretched Brescia as he cut across Ellis Mateo to bury a shot in the far corner. I didn't realise how rare a thing that was.
Yeah.
But it's never been done before. Ever in Serie A. So well done, Thiago Motta.
Yeah. By the way, we should say that their match against Juventus. So Genoa were down to 9 men in the 57th minute against Juve.
Yeah.
And nearly held on for a draw. It was 1-1, and then finally in the 96th, Cristiano Ronaldo
scored a penalty.
They were that close. I mean, what an incredible effort. Now, Rabiot did go off with a red card of his own in the 87th, but still, Genoa playing that long with 9 men against the best team in the league.
It's great.
I feel terrible for them that they couldn't see it out. They were right there.
It's great credit to Thiago Motta what he's done so far.
Yeah. Let's see. My man of the match, JJ, as I referenced earlier, it is Nick De Leon. I just couldn't get over the moment last night and the quality of that goal from a guy who, while not unknown by any means, is starting to carve out an amazing reputation of being a scorer of great and important goals. He's 29 years old. This is his 8th year in the league. He's never had a year with more than 6 goals, which he did his rookie year, and he did it again this year. In fact, in the 3 years before this year, he scored a total of 1 goal. And yet, let's now take a look at his resume of goals that he has scored. Obviously, you have the moment from last night, which, like I said earlier, now goes down in history as one of the big MLS goals ever scored. Remember, also, he came off the bench in the first round for Toronto FC against DC United to score and assist in extra time. Then last year, while he was with DC United, in the 116th minute, he came off the bench to do this against Columbus Crew.
Rooney driving this in, Birnbaum waiting for it, got his hand to it, takes a bounce, Zardes only as far as De Leon!
Remember that incredible volley that he scored in the 116th, and it sent that game to penalties where they eventually went on to win? And then MLSsoccer.com actually did a profile on this, and I was reading through it, and I was reminded of another big one that he scored his rookie year while for DC United in the 88th minute to send his side past the Red Bulls in the playoffs. This is like, for a guy who's never been much of a goal scorer, he's put together just like an incredible resume of huge goals. I'm wondering, I have a name in mind. I'm wondering if you can think of like the EPL version of him.
A big-time goal scorer.
Like a guy who has scored some just truly memorable goals without ever really being like a top scorer or even remotely close to it. Really a glorified sub throughout much of his career. There's one name you should... I mean, how have you not said it already?
It's not Solskjaer.
JJ, he's MLS Origi.
Divock Origi.
How many big goals does he score? He's started like two games in his life.
Yeah, I suppose in the last year, that's true.
It's incredible. Yeah. We didn't even mention he scored in the 94th and the 5-5 just to send it to penalties.
That is true.
Divock De Leon, MLS Origi.
Divock De Leon. All right.
Yep. So there you go.
Whew.
What a show. What a show. Should be a fun weekend of EPL action. And now we really just kind of sit and wait for the title. JJ, of course, will be reviewing all of Josie Altidore's medical records in the days leading up. And he will make the decision as to whether or not Josie is good to go.
Just because I have had a similar track record of injuries, me and him are kindred spirits, Andrew.
Yeah. Well, hey, this was a lot of fun, man. Lots of fun. To you, I say...
Take you later, fun boy.
I'll see you.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast. We'll be right back.